When Bibi Moore Campbell's parents got a divorce, it opened up two worlds to the young girl. For most of the year, she lived with her mother and grandmother here in Philadelphia. That was a world of advice and Christian morality. These maternal figures were a tad protective. That's why she called them the bosoms. Summers, though, she'd spend with her father in North Carolina in a world of men, with Fruit of the Loom hanging on the clothesline and baseball games on TV. Campbell has written a memoir called Sweet Summer, Growing Up With and Without My Dad. In it, she reflects on the male and female influences that shaped her childhood and on the two worlds of black culture she lived in the North and in the South. Campbell is also the author of a book about pressures in contemporary marriages titled Successful Women, Angry Men, Backlash in the Two-Career Marriage. Bibi Moore Campbell is my guest today. I asked her to begin by reading an excerpt from her new book, Sweet Summer.
It has proved to be true what I felt looking into my father's satin-lined casket. My loss was more than his death, much more. Those men who used to entice me with their storytelling, yank my plaits, throw me quarters, and tell me what a pretty girl I was, are mostly beyond my reach now. But that's all right. When they were with me, they were very much with me. My father took to his grave the short-sleeved, beer-swilling men of summer, big bellies, raucous laughter, pipe smoke, and the aroma of cigars. My daddy is really gone, and his vacant place is my cold, hard border. As always, my life is framed by his absence.
Bibi Moore Campbell, Bill Cosby is right. This is a wonderful book. And for those who are summer daddies like myself, with, in fact, a 7-year-old little girl, it really comes right home. I wonder, can you go back to when you were a 7-year-old? About this time of year, I guess it would be.
Yeah.
Towards the end of June.
Right.
You're sitting on your stone steps, bap, bap, bapping your heel against the step and waiting for your daddy to come around the corner.
Well, there was a terrific feeling of anticipation after school ended because I knew I was about to be transported from one world to another. I was about to leave, you know, the asphalt, the pavement of Philadelphia, the home on 16th Street, where I live with my mother, my grandmother, sometimes my aunt, and always my cousin. But this world of perfume and Jergens hand lotion and women. And I was about to be transported down to rural North Carolina with the dismal swamp and the lane that was unpaved that led to my grandmother's house and spend the next 2.5 months with my father. And so it was just transporting me to another world. And I just, at seven, my father was the king for me. And so I was sitting on the steps waiting for the king to come get me and transport me and take me. And I anticipated everything about it. I wanted that first glimpse of him. I wanted to get in his car. I wanted to go to my Uncle Eddie's market, which was around the corner from my mother, so that we could get sodas and stuff for our trip.
And you could show off your daddy's and his big green and Buick and Pontiac, I guess.
Pontiac.
Right.
And I wanted the long ride. It wasn't, you know, I didn't mind that it was long. I never asked, you know.
How long was it?
Then it was about 8 or 9 hours because now they have the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, but then we had a ferry. So just the ferry trip alone was like at least an hour or two waiting in line and getting on. And so it was a long trip, but it certainly was the highlight of my summer.
Now, I was struck by how much touch is a part of your memory here. You were touching one another all the time. He'd have his big, thick arm on your shoulder. You'd be holding his wrist. And I remember just how vivid that is for you, that just the physical presence of...
My father was, I guess you call him touchy-feely. The texture of him, I mean, my mother and my grandmother and my aunt were also, so I come from hugs and kisses on both sides, but his touch, of course, was a manly touch, and so I remember it because it was so different. I only got that, you know, 2.5, 3 months out of the year whereas I was clasped into these bosoms for most of the rest of the year.
Now, it's important, obviously, in the story, an important element of this story is your father was a paraplegic. He'd been in a car accident
right.
when you were very young.
When I was 10 months old.
So he had to lift himself out of the car and always had a wheelchair with him. And
he
what,
had...
Was he a kind of wounded man in your eyes? Was he flawed in any way for that?
No. If anything, I saw him as a child as special. I saw him as someone who... You have to understand, I never saw my father walk. In any of my memories, I was 10 months old when he had that car accident. So I just saw him as a special person. Because I had him on such a pedestal, my feeling was that somehow some wicked person had done this to him. Because I wasn't getting any input from anybody when I was very young as to how this accident had happened. And it was one of the challenges of growing up to come to grips with the fact that my father was not this perfect king that I had always placed on a pedestal, but he was a flawed human being who drove too fast.
Did he? Oh, that's why he was in the accident?
Well, he was the only one involved in this accident, and he drove fast.
And yet he tried to show you that he really was all there in physical strength. He changed the tire when you were driving
right.
down at one point.
Yeah, and I guess that's why my father never exuded helplessness. Quite the opposite. He washed his car. He changed a tire. He was very. He bowled. He played basketball. So I saw him as not able-bodied, but not helpless.
I'm talking with Bebe Moore Campbell. Her new memoir, Sweet Summer: Growing Up With and Without My Dad. Robert Bly, a poet whose stuff I and a lot of men are interested in, talks about what is missing when the physical presence of the dad isn't there, not just for girls, but for children, period. And he says it after the Industrial Revolution, even. Girls could always chat in the kitchen with their grandmas and their mothers, but we have, on average, 10 minutes a day with their fathers. That physical presence is really mm-hmm. important. Is there anything in that for you? Just what does that bring?
Well, when I think of what I wouldn't have had if I hadn't had the time with my father, what he gave for me as a daughter, and I think it is what men give their little girls, is the expectation that I should be loved and should be cherished by a man at some point. He made that the norm for me. Whereas if you don't have that, I'm not saying this is the sole reason, but I think a lot of women have difficulty overcoming not having had that input from a father when they later on grow up and have relationships and marriages with adult men. Fathers set the groundwork for little girls.
How do you mean?
Well, what I mean is when fathers are, and this can a father can be in the house and not be nurturing and not be giving, but certainly when a father is there for his little girl, whether he's a father of divorce, part-time parent, or in the home, his presence says to her, you're lovable, you're worthwhile, you're worth daddy coming over to get you on a weekend, you're worth daddy coming 9 hours from North Carolina to pick you up every summer. And that builds self-esteem. On the other hand, when that's...
Even if you try and test him by freaking him out with wild hairdos and everything
yeah,
else?
Yeah, but I mean, the bottom line is, if you get this message early enough, it builds a base of security that'll last you for the rest of your life.
And yet you portray your father as not totally without flaws. I mean, he farts.
Yes, he did.
And not so slyly.
No, not so slyly. Yeah, that was, you didn't hear farts in the home of the bosoms, my mother, my grandmother, my aunt, little poots maybe. But, I mean, my father's passing gas could really shake the house down. And you didn't want to be around when it happened. But it was one of the textures of my childhood, so to speak. And something I remember. You know, that was, he was a man. He did manly things in a manly way.
Now, where did you come to see, though, that he might have more fundamental weaknesses, let's say? I mean, that's not a weakness to fart, but...
No. Well, I think I began to see, once I began to get a grip on how my father got hurt, how that accident occurred, I began to see someone who really put a lot of stock into a fast car. And I think it was, I don't think of my father as a daredevil, but I think he was a very, very aggressive, ambitious man, a black man coming up in North Carolina in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and he wanted a lot. And I think, and this is not as an excuse because people speed for whatever reasons, but I think part of his feeling important was tied into having a car and really feeling powerful behind the wheel.
Your grandma didn't seem to mind that. His mother.
I mean, no.
The part in the book where she says, that's okay, he yeah. wants to drive his fast car.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my grandmother loved her children, and everything that that they did was okay by her, most things. I mean, she forgave them for most things.
But you haven't really forgiven him for being that reckless with himself.
I think because I had put him on so high a pedestal when I was little, if I had known early on the cause then for my father's paralysis, then it would have been easier to make, to never put him on a pedestal than to have him fall off. I thought this man was perfect, and then to find out that he was reckless and that he drove too fast, I was very angry. I was very angry for a while, but I think part of growing up and part of maturing was my coming to grips with that and accepting him as not the king, but daddy with some flaws.
Did your mother ever give you the impression that she either resented or was jealous of how close you were with him?
Oh, no, never. My mother wanted that. My mother's very smart, and she's, a trained social worker, so she knows all that stuff about what daddies do for little girls. So absolutely wanted me to have a close relationship with him. And again, whatever hostility they had toward each other, they were able to manage it so that it didn't interfere with either of their relationships with me. He held her in high esteem as far as I was concerned. She held him in high esteem.
And he died before, he died when you were about 27. Seven, and by that time you had married?
I had married, and I had a child. My child, Maia, was 4 months old when my father was killed in another car accident.
Uh-huh. Tell me about your summers now in the South. It just from the first couple of chapters of your book, they're glorious, like you're a pig in whatever the opposite of New Nile is.
Well... I have to preface it. Summers in North Carolina, or North Carolina in the 50s, was a very, very segregated place to be. Couldn't go to movies, couldn't go to the library. It was very rural. And I think I say this to say that my family was so protective, and by that I mean my father, my grandmother, my cousins, my extended family, that I didn't feel all of that. I saw it whizzing by as I'd go down the highway and see for colored signs, for white signs, but it didn't really get into my marrow. And I think that's what a family can do for you. They can protect you. And of course, I was a visitor to a certain extent. I didn't go to a segregated school in North Carolina where they would not have been able to protect me from that. But the summers for me, instead of being harsh places of repression that North Carolina was for a lot of black people. Summers were this time where there were all these flowers, a lot of hummingbirds, trees to climb, chickens to chase, dogs to run around with, hogs. And most important was that summer was a time when all my uncles and aunts came back on Labor Day and we had family reunion. So I got to see cousins that I hadn't seen, both from North Carolina and Virginia and from Philadelphia and other points north. So it was a reunion time, and it was certainly a time with no pressures. I mean, you didn't have homework to do. You didn't have... manners, everything absolute could slide grace. A little bit, yeah.
But was there anything in you that wanted to look down on that from the heights of where your bosoms, the Philadelphia background was, and say, this is a bit just hick?
No.
Was there anything in you that was critical of that?
No. Late as I grew up and got to be an adolescent and got interested in boys, then I said, this is too slow. And then again, we're talking about having a boyfriend back in Philadelphia, and you're up a muddy lane with no phone. What was paradise at 7, 8, 9, 10 became less so at the age of 14, 15, 16, because then I wanted more of what Philadelphia had to offer.
You didn't have any boyfriends down in South Carolina?
No, North Carolina, no.
North Carolina, yeah. So we got you to 14 and with boyfriends waiting for you in Philadelphia, calling long distance down to...
Not calling long distance, no phone, writing.
Oh, I see. Things must have had to change with your dad at that point, too. You couldn't be as physical with him, I guess. You weren't able to sleep with him.
Oh, no. Yeah, when I was little, I slept in the bed with my father and enjoyed that because we'd talk a lot. And then one summer, I think I was about 9 or 10, I came down and my grandmother had removed me. I put my bags in my father's room and she just said, you're not sleeping there. And I said, why not? And she said, you're too big. And she sent me upstairs to sleep with my cousin, Bunny. And I was just very upset about this because I liked that time with my father. I liked the talking. And I said, well, you know, talk to her, telling my father, talk to your mother. And he agreed. He said, no, you are too big. You have to go upstairs with Cousin Bunny. And I began to understand it a few years down the road, but that was really traumatic for me then.
Almost a rejection.
Yeah, I couldn't be with my daddy, who I idolized, you know.
He spent a lot of time with other men, and you had his brothers, the seven brothers. But it was a kind of mystery world, too, yes? I mean, there were times when they'd say, Bibi, just take off. This is men talk now.
Yeah, they would be out. My grandmother had a lot of land around her house, and so they'd line up their cars, and they all had very nice cars, Fords and Pontiacs and big, shiny cars, and they'd wash them. And, you know, they'd take their shirts off, and I'd just come creeping up to hear what they were saying, and they might be saying something they didn't want me to hear. So they'd sort of indulge me for a little while, then maybe I'd get chased away. But I much preferred their company to being with my aunts and the women and my grandmother.
Now, why was that?
I mean, because it was different. I didn't have that most of the time in Philadelphia. I was around women all the time, and I like being around men. And these were men who were nurturing, who would tell me I was cute, who would give me a quarter, who would pull my plaits, who made it clear that they liked me a lot. I mean, they didn't want me to be around if they were maybe saying a cuss word or two, so then I would be banished, but they liked my company.
Well, your aunts, your aunt and mother and grandmother loved you, presumably.
Oh,
the same.
I love
I'm not
them
trying
too.
To defend them, except
no, I
they're
love
just
them
wondering
too.
What... Yeah.
I love them too, but I wanted that different energy that I didn't get the whole school year. And I missed them very much, and I was always very happy to get back to see them again. But I don't know if there's such a thing as male deprivation, but I didn't have enough maleness in my life during the school year, and I just absorbed every bit of it that came my way when I was down in North Carolina.
So are you directing this book mostly to mothers to say, leave room, don't be
well,
angry?
Well, one of my messages is, if it is possible for mothers to and fathers to come to grips. A lot of times, I shouldn't say a lot of times, but sometimes men aren't a positive influence on their children. Particularly during these times, you got men on drugs, you got men that you don't want around your kids. But sometimes a man who's maybe struggling out of work has a positive contribution to make that isn't financial. The society being as it is, sometimes women can't see what that man can provide and is giving the message, look, if you don't have a check, just don't bother to come around here. What I'm saying to those women is to look for ways to make it possible. I think we've got to start being creative about child support. It may not always need to be money. Sometimes it may be time. Sometimes that ex-husband who's out of work, if he'll take care of the kids, if he'll watch them, again, if he's a positive person, that frees up the mother who is working to maybe, you know, work longer, do overtime, go back to school, that kind of thing. A lot of time you've got fathers who, and mothers being hostile, fathers don't, maybe they're working, they don't want to give this woman money. They're saying she's going to spend it on the boyfriend, she's going to spend it on herself. Okay, if that's the problem, I think, and again, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not an expert, but my feeling is, in beginning to work out this anger, what is to prevent a man from going to the home where his children live, ringing the doorbell, and leaving two bags of groceries? What is to prevent him from going to that same door, leaving clothes in his children's size? Why can't he find out who babysits his children and give the check directly to that person? Get the pediatrician and send the check directly to him. In other words, when men are serious about providing for their children, they find ways of doing it, even if they're very angry with their ex-wives.
That's asking a lot for...
That's asking a lot, but it means a lot. It means more than it's than I'm asking for. It means the future of their children.
I'm talking with Bebe Moore Campbell, whose new memoir is Sweet Summer, Growing Up With and Without My Dad. Talking about the way young daughters particularly are with men, it's one of the sadnesses of the way things are is that we look at an old man, say your uncle's age or with young girls, and we look askance at them being physical with one another. That's extreme, but there are ways that we don't seem to encourage in the culture the kind of just hanging out.
Mm-hmm. Certainly when we have a father missing from a household with a young boy, the society steps in to provide a role model for that boy. We've got police athletic league. We've got big brothers. We've got boys clubs. We don't do that for little girls. The society assumes that mothers are enough of a role model for daughters, so therefore if the father is not around, that little girl is still going to come out okay. And I don't know what the answer for that is, actually, because we're a society now, we're learning about molestation, we're learning about all kinds of awful things, and I think we're a bit paranoid about certainly partnering a grown adult strange male with a small girl.
Or even the father of the
sometimes
girl.
That. Yeah, but I think we've got to become aware of how much and how necessary fathers are to daughters and how much little girls need that male image in their lives. And we've got to, you know, find the safest male, so to speak, in that situation, whether that's the father, the grandfather, the uncle, or the neighbor next door. I think mothers have got to become aware, if they're the custodial parent, and they're 90% of the time they are, that their daughters need input from men as much as their sons.
There's a wonderful character in your book. Is it Mr. Abe? No, he wasn't an uncle.
He was my step-grandfather, yeah.
But tell me about him.
Oh, Mr. Abe was...
He would sing all the time.
Yeah, he was my grandmother, my father's mother's second husband, and he was a farmer and a man of very, very few words, but a man who would sing every night. He sat in a chair. He had few pastimes. He had a huge storybook of Bible stories with huge and large print because his eyes weren't that good. He read that and the Bible every night, and he sang. He would sing for like 2 hours a night. He would just sit in a chair and hum, moan, sing hymns. And they were hymns I've never heard anywhere before or since I heard him sing them. And they really...
Did you learn them yourself? Were you able to sing them to my ear?
Never. I mean, it was not music you'd go out of the house humming. It was just, these were Mr. Abe's songs. And, but they were like background music for my whole North Carolina experience. But again, I never, you know, they were just, it's humming, it was moaning, it was very ancient music. I could tell it was ancient music.
When you were writing this, did you go back and talk with any of your relatives just to get details right, or was
yes.
it all there?
Yeah, I talked with some uncles and some aunts. I talked with cousins, and I talked with old friends. I remembered a lot, but I didn't remember everything. So I had to talk with some people.
But your nose had a good memory.
I remembered my smells, yes, I did. I remembered the smell of the hair pomade my Nana used to put on my hair. New Nile, which sort of smelled peachy, apricotty. And I remembered the smell of her pound cake and their perfumes. Living with a House of Women, it's like being in a perfume store. And the Avon, the Topaz cream sachet, and Intimate that my Aunt Ruth wore, and Emerald that my mother wore, and my first grade teacher wore Emerald. And so, yeah, I remember all those scents. I don't know why I remember them, but I do.
It's a wonderful read. It's a wonderful smell. B.B. Moore Campbell, thank you very much.
Thank you.